Hey, everybody, it's Mark. I'm back with another great episode of Finding Your Summit, all about people overcoming adversity and finding their way. And before we get into this week's phenomenal guest, I want to remind everybody about my website, because on my website, I've got over 175 podcasts that are there full of amazing people doing incredible things. If you want to find out more about that, please go to www.markpattisonnfl.com. And I would greatly appreciate some love on iTunes. There's a little button right there. You can punch it. It will take you over to iTunes. You can give us a ratings and review. It matters so much in terms of the world of more exposure in the Apple universe. So please do that. Also, as many of you know, I'm exactly 5 months, 10 days, 21 hours, and about 53 minutes away from launching to Mount Everest to take on that big beast. We're going to get more into that later in the podcast, so you can find out all about that. Also, very cool that Garmin has an app, which is connected now into my website. You can actually trace me going up the mountain and trace me coming all the way back down, hopefully safely, and back to the U.S. with that accomplishment under my belt. And finally, as many people know, I have now partnered with Higher Ground, very cool organization here in Sun Valley, Idaho, and we are trying to raise money in a campaign that we're calling the Amelia's Everest, the Lhotse Challenge. My daughter has epilepsy, and so we've been trying to attack that. We partner with Higher Ground. Many of what and who they support are military people with PTSD and other adaptive issues that they've had. Being over in Afghanistan. And anyways, it's a great organization. And together we're trying to come and raise that money, $27,940. We're well under our way, which happens to be the height of Lhotse, the fourth highest mountain in the world. Okay. So on that note, let me jump into the podcast today. I've got an amazing person, Hillary Nelson. First of all, Hillary, how are you doing?
I am great. How are you? Thanks for having me.
Yeah, you know what? I mean, I've been chasing you for months, and there's certain people I get my eyes locked on, and like, I've got to have this person. And I tried and tried and tried, and you're a busy person. You're going all over the planet. You're doing these amazing things. And finally, we had a common friend connect us, and I'm so happy that happened. You're in Telluride. I've never been there. I want to go. I'm in Sun Valley, two ski towns. But, you know, really at the core, we're connected by this common thread of Seattle, Washington. That's where I grew up. And I want to jump in.
And where I grew up. Yeah.
Yeah. And where you grew up and the where the common thread of the through line through this is that you are just an incredible climber, mountaineer, skier, and we'll get into these incredible feats that you've done. But I've shared my story many times. They said, Mark, how did you get into climbing and trying to become the first NFL player to climb the seven summits? And it always starts with where I grew up. And you know, like, so often you're influenced by that. But for you, the story could be identical, very mountainous community, Mount Rainier. But where did it start for you, where you began this, really this foundation of this legendary career that you've had so far?
Well, ironically, it took me leaving Seattle to find my way as a mountaineer and even really discover what that was, and a ski mountaineer at that. I skied from a super young age at Stevens Pass in Washington.
Yep.
And I skied at Crystal, and I skied a few times at Baker. Like, there's amazing, amazing mountain ranges surrounding Seattle. And a lot of people I know who discovered mountains have moved to Seattle for that reason. I happen to have had an opposite path, and that I ended up leaving to go to Colorado to go to university. And I think it was there that I first started going uphill with my skis instead of just downhill, and really fell in love with it. But I would say my real connection to wanting to do this for the rest of my life was after living in Chamonix in France and experiencing the Alps and the history they have with alpinism, and just really influenced the last 20 years of my life.
So how do you do that? I mean, again, you've had over 40 different expeditions. I'm setting this now up for the audience. You've been voted National Geographic, you know, Person of the Decade and Men's Journal. You know, you've had these amazing awards, right, for these incredible accomplishments you've done. You've had a number of different firsts. We'll get into that on these different mountains that you've done. Yeah. Like, how does somebody turn that from a hobby into a place where North Face and other people are recognizing you, they're funding you, they're getting behind you in a way that really makes a difference, and you can turn that into a career like that?
Well, I mean, to be honest, when I first started down this path, I didn't think it would actually be a career. I was working, you know, three different jobs. I was also a heli ski guide. I was doing everything I could to make ends meet and really just following a passion, a love, something that I found myself to be really good at. And I wanted to see how far that could take me, I guess, and where I could go, and just sort of learning my physical and mental boundaries within the sport of ski mountaineering. And as I progressed, it just had a lot of doors open for me, partly because I was a female in a fairly male dominated world, the world of mountaineering in general. And I think partly because I really like to push myself. I really want to know what my boundaries are, and then I want to like blast through them and push myself further. So That's something that mountaineering really lets you do. I'm sure you'll experience this on Everest as well, with altitude, because that's another sort of niche to my sport. And you know, it probably wasn't until I was 5, 6, 7 years into this path, I had sponsorship from North Face, that I started focusing solely on being a pro athlete in that regard, and letting go of some of the other jobs and starting to make some money enough to sort of support what I wanted to do, what I love to do.
Yeah. I mean, that's just incredible when you can take that passion. You know, a lot of, you know, for me going back into the NFL, you know, people have said, well, you know, how did you make all the way to the NFL? And it was going back to when I was just a little kid and growing up in Seattle, and having that incredible experience going from level to level to level all the way through high school into college, into the NFL. So you just don't get there in one step. So I think the key of everything that we're talking about is really true purpose and passion. And for so many people, that's so hard. But if you lead by that, it's such a path well-deserved and rewarding, and everything else have you found. And not only are you traveling all over the world, you're going to these super remote places that, you know, frankly, most people have never gone. You've purposely chosen some of these places that are so remote.
Yeah.
You've actually become the first person to actually be in these places. So how did you, like, you get into this arena, and now how do you start picking different spots that you're looking at this like, no other woman has done this or that, or I want to go to a place that's so physically challenging and tough, I'm going to guide this group. Like, how did that all come together?
I mean, I think it kind of goes back to you speaking about progression. It didn't happen overnight, of course. I mean, I've been doing this for 20 years now. And when I first started, I was very much, you know, like the deer in headlights, eyes wide open, totally overwhelmed most of the time with some of the experiences. And eventually I found myself really drawn to really remote places that required, you know, have a very mathematical brain. So places that really required a lot of logistical planning, places that, despite the logistical planning, things often were a mystery. Things totally would go awry, and it was all about thinking on your feet. It was all about adjusting adversity, all things that really go back to that initial experiential passion of knowing my boundaries, blasting through them. How could I do better? How can I be more? How can I learn more? And so ironically, many of those things weren't even on the mountain. They were, you know, traveling to get to the mountain or traveling to get back. I mean, some of my, probably my most remote expedition was one to Burma with National Geographic. And that was only in 2014. So I'd already been doing this for, you know, some 14 years. And that trip still just leveled me. But at the same time, I walked away from that just having learned so much about myself and my pluses and my minuses, if you will.
What challenged you?
I mean, it was the utter remoteness. It was incredibly challenging. We had a really talented team, but a team of individuals, to say the least, versus a team that was able to work as a team. So more something that was unique to this was that the team really fell apart. And to that point in my career, I hadn't experienced that to such an extent. We, you know, ran out of food. We walked 150 miles through a jungle just to get to the base camp of the mountain. And then the mountain turned out to be just this complicated alpine version of a jungle. It was just crazy. So many things just went awry that I felt pretty lucky that we all walked out of there with our fingers and toes and all alive, to be honest.
Yeah. So tell me how you, and I'll give you an example. I'm going to ask you the question. I'm going to give you an example. Okay. So okay. How have you developed your mindset? You're a really tough chick, right? And so, you know, for me, I have always felt like football really gave me that foundation. And what I mean by that is that a lot of people can sit and they can study something all day long, but I believe that your body has to be physically so toned and in so such peak performance and ready to go that when those tough moments come up, you've tested yourself so many times because you put yourself through the drill so many different times that you mentally then can break through that barrier to get to where you want to go. And I'm curious on, like, you didn't play football, I don't think.
My family was really into football, so I know a lot about it.
Yeah, so that's great, but that didn't necessarily get you mentally tough. Like, I'm trying to find, like, what was that? Like, you look back on all these, you know, you've been doing this for 20 years, but this could be going back all the way to Stevens Pass, where, by the way, I used to Big Chief or whatever. I used to ski, you know, all the time, right?
Yeah.
Run up there.
Yeah.
But where is it, do you think you like really cut your chops and you went from just this, you know, little kid or little girl, whatever you want to call it, to going across the bridge to the other side of, like, this is kind of a new Hillary?
I almost think it was when I chose to go out of Washington State for college. And the background to that is my family is very deeply rooted in Seattle, very deeply rooted in the University of Washington and everything around Seattle. And as a result of that, I grew up in a very family-oriented way, a very protected and sheltered home. I was the youngest. I had the big brother that looked out for me all the time. I had the same group of friends that I played basketball with. That was a huge part of my life as a kid, was playing basketball. And I played basketball with the same girls from the age of 8 to 18. And so for me to step away from that and go out on my own to a state that, you know, no one, I'd never been to and didn't know anyone there. And I immediately found friends that got me into rock climbing and ski touring. And I think that was the question mark I always had about myself growing up, was I can do all these things with all this help and all this familiarity, but I want to see who I am when I'm by myself and I'm forging my own path. Mm-hmm. And so this very much was that big first step. And I survived it and I even thrived in this forging my path environment. And, you know, now, you know, I jump forward 20 plus years from college and maybe I took it to a really high level of forging my own path. But I think that was really where it started for me, was just having independence.
Yeah, no, I can really appreciate that. And I was just actually the opposite. I went to Roosevelt High School. I grew up near the University of Washington. You know, I kind of grew up in that Sandpoint, Lowerhurst area. Yep. And my whole circumference was, you know, from the University of Washington to where I grew up in my high school, it was like 5 miles if you went in a circle, right?
Yeah.
And right. My whole family went up there. My mom was a cheerleader for the University of Washington, you know, all those different things. And I was incredibly fortunate because of my football pursuits that I was offered to go all over the country, right?
Right.
So I could literally have been here versus there and out of state. And I just wasn't in that place mentally. And so I think that takes a really brave thing. And probably one of the most mature things that I've ever done is just recognize that I wasn't mature enough to go away.
Right.
Right. And you kind of have the opposite effect of like, you know what, the best thing that could really be empowered by is just stepping out and really getting independent and having to forge my own way. And that, you know, like you said, if there's a successful path with that and you happen to, you know, buddy up with the right people, as right. it sounds like you did, that can just launch you in just ways you would have never imagined, you know, a million years. And so I'm sure you're thankful to some of those friends that you happen to meet. You know, I've had Scott Millen on the pod. He's yep. over at Aspen. You're in Telluride. I'm in Sun Valley. You know, we love these ski towns. What is it for you about Telluride that you said, you know, you've kind of gone the opposite and you grew up in Seattle and you did all this outdoor stuff, but you know, now you truly are in Colorado. It's a great state. Amazing mountain ranges, a lot of 14,000 peaks. What is it about Telluride that's been your draw to be in that place, in that state versus the state of Washington?
Well, I discovered Telluride for the first time when I was in college. I came here and was really blown away by the town itself. It's an old mining town. It's one way in, one way out. We're, you know, in a very tight box canyon with big mountains all around us. And I think I first came here when I was 19 years old and I ran a race called the Imogene Pass, which is an 18-mile race that starts in a town on the other side of the San Juans. And you kind of go up and over this 13,000-foot pass and down into town. And I'd never done anything like it before. And it blew me away. And I remember really thinking that I wanted to live here. And then a few years went by, you know, life happened and I met a guy and the guy lived in Telluride. And this was kind of at the end of my stint in Chamonix. I'd been in Chamonix for 5 years at this point and I wanted to move back to the States for a variety of reasons. And this guy, Brian, lived here. And so I came back and I lived in Telluride because to me, this was the closest thing I could get in the United States to what Chamonix was for me in terms mm-hmm. of living in the mountains, walking across the street, getting on the chairlift and having that mountain community. And I ended up marrying Brian. We are now divorced, but we still live, you know, a block and a half away from each other. And now I have kids and they live here and really it's just an incredibly strong community. One niche that I have found in my ski mountaineering world is that I'm really good at high altitudes. And so Telluride is one of the best places I can think of to train for these big Himalayan expeditions because I live at 9,000 feet. Everything goes up from here. I can get up even in the summertime, I can get up to 12,000 feet. And I remember training for the Lhotse ski expedition. And in one day I summited, I think 13,000 foot peaks and stayed above, you know, between 12 and 14,000 feet for 10 hours. And the rock's really bad around here. So that's good for training for sketchiness and, you know, scrappiness. These are really scrappy mountains and I like being scrappy. I like fingernails hanging by my fingernails and I get that here.
Yeah. I love that. You know, I think like another lessons in life, it's very metaphorical in terms of the mountains and the mountaineering and things that you get and step by step and going up and finding your summit and all these things. And one of the, this is 3 years ago that I you know, I was well into the Seven Summit Pursuit. I think I'd done four of the seven at the time. And I decided to move to Sun Valley. So I was living in California And it was just like, you know what? I need to be training. So like you, I'm looking at my window across the street. It's the mountain. And yeah. I'm not at 9,000 feet. I'm at 6, but
yeah,
still, it's still, you're getting up and you're going down. You're not at sea level. Right. And it is right. Seriously mattered. And so far I can only knock on wood because I haven't been above 23,000, but you know, knock on wood, you know, we'll see how things go next March, but
yeah,
you know, it's certainly helped in terms of just my endurance and my ability to be and access the mountains immediately. And, and then the unifying benefit throughout all this is that I can go across the street and hug an aspen every day, right? I don't have to go search for it. And being in nature, especially in these times right now, we're talking today on October 20th, this pod will play in a couple of weeks. And we're still dealing with the pandemic. We're still dealing with the potential outcome of the presidential race. Black Lives Matter. There's a lot of craziness that's going on in the world right now. And it seems like you get in these little ski towns and we're in these bubbles where it's not like they're not important, but it's just not a high density of people living in a concentrated area that create a lot of the madness that we're seeing in these bigger cities right now.
Right. I mean, I do feel very fortunate to live here. I think I've always, my biggest thing to anyone listening to this podcast is that for me, and I feel so strongly about this, whether you live in a city, no matter where you live, if you can just take 10 minutes in a day and find a park or find a way to walk around the block and be outside, it's always been my go-to place to scream at the top of my lungs or to let out whatever frustrations I have in life. And, you know, again, I'm really fortunate to live here, but God, I hope everyone can find that space wherever you live to just manage the things we're going through and just life in general.
Absolutely agree.
Yeah.
You're so right. You really get a clarity in your head too. If you can get up from your station, your computer station, and go walk around the block or take an hour and go do this. And you come back.
Yeah.
And like, I wasn't even thinking about that. You can really, you know, unstuck, whatever the word is, whatever you're lodged on at the time. I want to ask you about something that I have coming up. You're the first woman to ever do the Mount Everest Lhotse combo within 24 hours. I'm trying to become the best NFL guy to do the same thing.
Yeah.
And let's talk about your experience though, because I haven't experienced
it.
So, you know, for anybody, let alone, you know, taking on one, you're taking on two. What was that like for you? So let's just describe this. So you're in Nepal, you've decided to climb Mount Everest, but there's a saddle that sits in between Mount Everest and Lhotse, the fourth highest mountain in the world. And you have the ability to access one after coming down, summiting the top of Everest. So what was that experience like for you to do not only one, but both those things successfully?
Well, so I was there I did this in 2012, and that was an incredibly busy year on Everest. And there's been a few, I think just maybe 2019 was the next busiest or busier than 2012. Yeah. I mean, everybody's seen all the crazy mayhem photos of the lines on Everest, and they're real. It's tricky, and timing is very difficult in order to differentiate yourself from a lot of the other teams. And in 2012, there just so happened to be a lot of bad weather and really tough climbing because we didn't have snow. So there are maybe only 3 summit windows, I think. So that took all those people and put them all going to the summit, you know, kind of at the same time. Mm-hmm. And I found myself incredibly frustrated trying to navigate the variety of skill sets in the people that were also climbing. And so our summit day took us over 12 hours, which is a really long time, especially when you're using oxygen. It's a really long time to be out. And the good weather hadn't quite come. So it was, I think, negative 50 degrees on the summit. And the condensation from my mask had actually dripped down and frozen my zipper. And I had all my water bottles were inside my down suit that I couldn't access because my zipper was frozen. There were all these crazy things. And let me just preface that by saying none of this diminishes what the summit is like at sunset on Mount Everest. So it is a worthwhile endeavor. It's an incredible experience. But it wasn't until I was walking down from Everest that I could see Lhotse and the Lhotse Couar. And it was at that point where we had permits, but we weren't expecting to actually do the second peak. And I just started talking to my partner, and he was like, I was like, we got to go do it. There's nobody over there. We got to go do it. This is going to be, we just got to keep going. I got to turn my energy around. And so we went down to Camp 4, which is about 26,000 feet, and rested a few hours and got up and kind of went, you have to actually go downhill a little ways to get over to the start of the climb for Lhotse. And then we went up Lhotse and came back down, and that whole climb took us about 5 hours with no people on it. So,
and what's the terrain difference between Mount Everest and Lhotse?
So the main southeast ridge on Everest is a ridge. Okay, so you're on an open face as you kind of leave the high camp, and then you gain a ridge. And to me, with my ski background, that's not typical terrain for me. So when I looked over at Lhotse, which is a couloir, so you have basically a ribbon of snow that goes straight up the mountain, doesn't meander at all, and on either side you have big cliffs that protect it.
Yep.
That's my like home run, if you will. That's what I'm used to. That's my terrain, especially living in Telluride. Everything we ski here is really defined as couloirs. So Everest, I was kind of a fish out of water with the terrain we were walking on, ridge walking, et cetera. And then to see Lhotse and be like that's me, that's my comfort zone. And you're just walking, you know, straight up, you've got cliffs. The cliffs are close enough on either side, you're touching them. So they're absolutely polar opposite the terrain you're using to climb. Even though 80% of the route on the approach of those two peaks is the same, once you actually get on the regular route of Everest, it's very different from Lhotse, which to me makes it more interesting, which is what you need when you've been awake all those hours and you're really distraught and tired from coming down from Everest. You need that extra kick of something interesting and different to keep the motivation up.
Yeah. No, I was going to ask you about your energy level. Yeah, I just watched for like the 60th time. You know, I'm constantly going on YouTube and these other Netflix and watching everything and try to like scout it out. Like I was watching my film, like I used to do in college and the NFL, right? Like, what's my opponent? What am I up against? You know, and trying to memorize and understand every single level as you go through. And when you came back to that 26,000 after being and going through this exhausting exercise of all these people that shouldn't be on the mountain. And by the way, this is my most frustrating thing in my mountaineering. I mean, you're way ahead of me, but just in like what I've been doing is usually I'm the strongest guy either in our group or on the hill. And so they always put me with the weakest people. And it just pisses me off because of the amount of training I do, you know, I have to go to the weakest link. And I know Everest will be slightly different, but that doesn't mean that I'm not going to come up from behind because my climbing pace is usually a lot faster than most. And having to meander around people and everything, all these things that you were talking about. And at the end of the day, what that equals is energy, right? Energy out. And so now you go through your 12 hours. Were you fried when you came back? And how many hours then were you in your tent before you strapped them back on and went back out to take on Lhotse?
So part of this, these lines of people when you're trying to summit Everest with these groups is that you're in a line. And the most common mistake that inexperienced climbers make is they take that Jumar and they ram it right up into the knots at the top of a line.
Yep.
And if you do that, you can't get the Jumar off the line. And so then everybody is just standing there waiting. You know, us being pro climbers, we would just take our Jumar off and just climb without a rope. But you had to move fast. So the biggest problem was not having a pace, not being able to have my pace and move at my pace. So I'd be going too slow. I'd get really cold. I'd unclip and then I'd run past 30 people, totally waste all my breath, everything. And then I'd clip back in and go until I got behind the next line. And then it was too slow, unclip, run past, clip back in. And what happened was by the time I got back down to Camp 4, I had fried my lungs. And so I was coughing. I was coughing up blood. I was pretty destroyed, to be honest. And at that point, this is where the like mental side of high altitude climbing kicks in. I was so mentally driven that I was, and so determined that, you know, I asked my partner, I'm like, I'm coughing up blood, but I don't have altitude sickness. It's not that. He's like, ah, you'll be fine. And, you kind of put your physicality aside and really charge with a mental fortitude that sort of explores those boundaries I was talking about earlier and really pushes through those boundaries. So we came down and gosh, we rested for a while, I think like almost 8 hours in the tent, but you know, you're still at 8,000 meters. So you're not sleeping. You're not eating very much. And then we set out, I don't know, maybe at 1 a.m., something like that the next morning. So we were up at 11, you know, prepping, getting everything going. 1 o'clock, we left the tent and we're able to ascend really fast because there are no people. It's a straight line. And the snow was really good. We had a lot of rock. It was a weird season without a lot of extra snow. But I think having that to look forward to in terms of a different style of climbing and a different set of parameters versus what we just experienced on Everest was really motivating and really helped me push through some of the physical challenges I was experiencing at the moment. So, I mean, I was awake for 50 hours straight, basically. By the time I got back down to Camp 2, I was like a narcoleptic. I mean, I was falling asleep mid-sentence. And we still, you know, had to pack up and go all the way back down to base camp that day. So it's a lot, but it's an incredible experience to sort of learn how much strength you have outside of physical strength.
Yeah. Well, that's a lot of, you know, sports just in general is just that mental fortitude, that stuff that you were talking about, that mindset, everything else.
Yeah.
So you become the first woman to ever do Everest in Lhotse within 24 hours. And then you did another first, which this was to me really cool. And I saw this film that you guys did. So your partner in more ways than one is Jim Morrison. And he's got an incredible story too. And by the way, I do have him scheduled. So this was part one and part two of the podcast, right?
Awesome.
And so yeah, staying on you though, your goal was to become the first female to ski the Lhotse face, which is steep and very narrow and very incredible. And it was just amazing. And I really want to promote this film. And I want you to tell us where we can find it. But the opening scene is like this drone sweeping shot of you two sitting on this lower rocky peak, and you're like looking at all the Himalaya with Everest in its grandeur with Lhotse and all these other mountains surrounding it, and like, whoa, right? And so anyways, where did you dream this up in terms of you two climbing up there and then skiing this thing down? And then, you know, what was that like? How scary was it? All that stuff. So the footage that you guys had, I'm not sure if you guys shot that, but it was incredible.
So we had two cameramen with us, Nick Kalish and Dutch Simpson, and they both had like zero experience in this environment. Neither of them had been above 20,000 feet before. They came into the expedition kind of last minute, and you know, both Jim and I were like, well, sweet, hopefully they'll make it to Camp 2, but they probably won't even make it through the ice fall. And lo and behold, they both summited with us and filmed the entire way. And just, I mean, they just did, those guys did such an amazing job. And where this idea hatched, Jim and I both came at it from different places. So obviously, when I was there in 2012, I had my skis with me with the intention of hopefully either skiing Everest or the Lhotse Kuar, but there was no snow. So that didn't happen. But I had just followed Himalayan climbing for so many years and knew about the Lhotse Kuar as one of the last remaining really pure ski descents in the 8,000 meter and above range. Jamie Laidlaw was the closest to making it happen in 2007, but he was forced to turn around when he got altitude sickness. He tried again in 2011 with the partner I was climbing with in 2012. And again, they had to turn around for altitude sickness and a variety of other reasons. So it's been tried a bunch. And 2012, it didn't work out to ski it, but we were able to climb it. And then it's just like you said, in terms of like really wanting to talk to me on a podcast, like you get something in your craw and you can't get it out until you actually go and do it. So that's the way I work with a lot of expeditions, is I start dreaming about them. And then once I start dreaming, they start waking me up at night. And then I start getting like cold sweats about them. And then I start formulating the plan in my mind. And then as soon as I start like talking about it out loud to people, I'm like, oh, I'm so screwed. Now I'm going. Now I know I'm going. And it's met with a lot of anxiety, a lot of excitement. And when Jim and I teamed up in 2015, 16, 2017, we had a lot of success on Denali and this peak in India called the Peak of Evil. And we were like, it's time. He'd always been drooling over Lhotse since he was a kid. And we just put our heads together, manifested it, and made it happen in 2018. So we went in the fall, which, as you know, is a really tough time. The off season. It's a tough time. So nobody summited Lhotse or Everest since 2006 in the fall season. So it's a huge risk, mostly because the Lhotse face is sort of the wall to both Everest and Lhotse, and it's 5,000 feet long, and if it has too much snow, it avalanches, and it's terrifying. And you know, we pushed so hard to be in the right place. And just to give you an idea, that expedition on Everest was a 10-week expedition, and on Lhotse in 2018, we were 5 weeks door to door. We just pushed and pushed and pushed. And we had a small team of five Sherpa who were just amazing. I mean, we couldn't have done it without them. So it was basically kind of the nine of us. We're the only people there, no one else, no other parties. So just experiencing the two sides of those mountains, you know, where there's a whole town, there's a whole city of people. It isn't without its charms. You know, you're climbing with people from all over the world. There's just crazy stuff going on. It's interesting. But then there's this other side that we got to experience in 2018 where we're the only people there. We were breaking the trail. We were putting the ropes in. God, that's the sunrise that morning that we summited Lhotse was pretty much the most spectacular thing I've ever seen.
Yeah, it's sick. And where can people find that YouTube video or maybe there's some other place?
You can find it on the North Face YouTube site. It's a 24-minute video, so it's pretty good, easy watching. And Nick and Dutch just did an amazing job of capturing all that footage.
Yeah, it was amazing. So you've had all these amazing accomplishments, and you continue to push. What do you see next for the world of Hillary?
Well, as with everyone, our reality has changed a little bit. So, you know, in March, I had an absolutely packed schedule of traveling and speaking engagements all the way through the end of November. And all of that has changed. All of that went away. So what is in store in the future? I'm still looking forward to expeditions and exploring. I'd really like to go back to the Himalaya. There's other amazing lines and first ascents to be had. One thing I'm really passionate about is the Arctic Refuge, which is up on the most northern part of Alaska. So I've been up there twice already, and I'm hoping to go back in April with a girlfriend of mine, Kit Delorier, and be the first people to ski all five of the highest peaks. We've done the top four. We just have one more to go. And then, you know, we usually spend a lot of time up there just kind of exploring the tundra and all the wildlife migrations and everything. So bring some of those stories back and hopefully reinstate some of the wilderness protections up there that have disappeared. So yeah, those are some of the things on the horizon. Spending a lot of time with my kids. Hopefully there's a ski race season this year for them, for their sake. So we'll see. Yeah.
Yeah. I think there's, if nothing else here, there's, it's just a great lesson in continuing to push the boundaries. People have said to me, so Mark, assuming that you summit Everest and that's your last, you know, is that it? I'm like, are you kidding me? The game has just begun.
Yeah.
Game has just begun. There's just so many things that I haven't done, like all these different places I want to go and see and visit and climb and challenge myself physically. And that doesn't have to be for everyone, but what the common denominator for everyone should be pushing the limits of whatever is uncomfortable for you to go see, you know, how far you can make it. So totally appreciate that. I want to ask you one last thing, which is where can people find you? You're a speaker, you go around, you're involved in a lot of different projects. Where can they find you?
Best place is probably my website, hillarynelson.com. Just go there and you can search through expeditions, publicity, learn a little bit more about things I've done and what I enjoy speaking about. I tour a lot for Nat Geo Live. And so I've been all around the country just talking about a lot of the things we've talked about today, adversity, you know, exploration, what that means, being outside, all of those things. So,
yeah, that's great. That's great. Well, listen, thank you so much for coming on. You're amazing. You're incredible. And I'm glad we finally connected up to do this. And, you know, a lot of things I'm going to take in, you know, in terms of what you were talking about, the Everest Lhotse combo and what to expect. So totally appreciate that. So thank you so much for coming on.
Yeah. Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Okay. There she is. The one, the only Hillary Nelson. Take care. Bye.
Hey, and thank you so much for listening to the Find Your Summit podcast. We are so glad to have you along for this journey. And if you enjoy the show, please tell a friend, share it on iTunes, spread it to the planet. We're looking to broadcast this to every person that is out there because, as you know, everybody has their own summit that they're going after. Okay, if you're looking to follow my journey, you can find that through my social links on markpattisonnfl.com. That's Mark, M-A-R-K, Pattison, P-A-T-T-I-S-O-N, nfl.com. So, until the next podcast, just remember, clear eyes, full hearts, and remember, it takes a little more to make a champion, so make it happen. Thank you. Bye.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.